KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories. And segues aren't always smooth, but the stories are interesting. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
First thing, you know, I was kind of hoping we wouldn't have any election nags until like the first part of next year, but we have runoffs. Election day is December 11th. You're just going to have to find your ballot. Either harrisvotes.com, or I have links at the top of every show post, or more or less at the top, where you can find your county clerk voting information, test ballots and stuff. Remember, local elections matter to you even more, much more than national elections. So if it's the school board, if it's the mayor, if it's a city council post, if it's the dog catcher, if that's an elective position where you live, vote, because you may not be happy with the dog catcher catching your dog, and you might want a dog catcher that will have a little mercy on your puppy. So yeah, every election matters, especially the local ones. Okay, first story from communityimpact.com: facing funding challenges, Houston looks for sidewalk fixes. A pair of Houston City Council members are looking to build momentum for several initiatives launched over the past few years by the city to improve sidewalks citywide. Not only improve them, but maybe install them. At-large council members Sally Alcorn and David Robinson collaborated on the inaugural Sidewalk Summit at the end of September, bringing together transportation advocates and city staff to discuss key policies city leaders want to implement to bring more sidewalks to neighborhoods in need. However, city staff and advocates said making headway on sidewalks could require the city to revisit how it thinks about funding. For the most part, city policy places the burden of sidewalk maintenance and construction, too, on individual property owners. As a result, management districts and tax increment reinvestment zones, or TIRs, also play a big role in the installation of new sidewalks, particularly in the Heights, River Oaks, and Montrose areas. Houston maintains about 4,000 to 5,000 miles of sidewalks across the city, Public Works Director Carol Haddock said. However, she said those sidewalks are not necessarily continuous or accessible. Houston, the city, builds new sidewalks when the work can be done alongside a road repair or hike and bike project. And residents can also request the city build a sidewalk if it will create a safe route to school, help a person with a disability, or is along a major thoroughfare, Haddock said. Installing more sidewalks can have cascading benefits, said Bill Fulton, director of the Rice Kinder Institute for Urban Research at the summit. For example, Rice Village is known to have heavy vehicular traffic, but Kinder's 2015 parking utilization study found there are 1,000 open parking spots available at any given time within a quarter-mile radius of the center. The study found people avoided those spots because they lacked accessibility and the ability that would allow them to walk to Rice Village, Fulton said. One of the things walkability does is encourages people to park in more logical places, not to cruise for parking spaces. That improves congestion in these areas. According to Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner, the availability and condition of our sidewalks is one of utmost importance. I think he said we've all seen sidewalks. They are there, but they're not usable. The pathway is no good to a person in a wheelchair if the path is too difficult to navigate. Alcorn said she'll advocate for the city to increase the percentage of its capital improvement plan that goes towards sidewalks. She also said she plans to consult with the city's legal and finance departments to look into whether a bond referendum is a viable option for Houston. Andrew sent me an article that I have a link there as a reference called Reluctant Localities Are Being Dragged into Court to Fix Sidewalks for People with Disabilities. This article is much longer. As usual, we strongly suggest that if you find a story interesting, go to the blog post at thinkwingradio.com, click on the link for the full story. Even the long stories have been, in most cases, dramatically excerpted and cut down. I once had Anise Parker on the show several years ago, and she had retired, basically had not run for re-election, and she was talking about her legacy and, you know, how she was trying to turn Houston into a walkable city. And, you know, my response was along the lines of, what about people that don't walk so good? You know, we want a parkable city. We want to have a place to put our car so that when we can't walk to a place, we can drive to a place. And she kind of stumbled with that. It wasn't the kind of response she was expecting, because everybody views a walkable city as a great thing. And it is. But sometimes walking is itself problematic. So, you know, you need a mix. Andrew? Yeah.
Well, yeah, we definitely need more sidewalks in Houston, in the area, and all of them. Even the ones that already exist need to be accessible. The article that I sent Mike and that you can find on the blog at thinkwingradio.com talks about some cities being sued over their sidewalks not meeting the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And this article about Houston specifically doesn't mention lawsuits from what I've read. But I have to wonder if that's sort of because of the way that sidewalks are deemed to be the responsibility of the property owner rather than the city in the majority of cases. Because there are some sidewalks that the city is responsible for, but it's only about, 4,000 to 5,000 miles?
4,000 to 5,000 miles of sidewalks around the city. Yeah. So there are parts of the Heights that are old neighborhoods, and they have sidewalks, although in many cases they're not particular. They're walkable, but you can trip and fall. Or if you have a wheelchair or a walker, it's going to be problematic because many of them have settled. They're breaking up from tree roots, all kinds of issues. So having a sidewalk is not in and of itself a victory.
Yeah,
it has to be a walkable or rollable sidewalk. And then you've got areas like mine where a lot of the houses used to be on quarter-acre lots, and then they were sold for townhouses or combined for townhouses, and then it was the builder's responsibility outside the townhouse cluster if they wanted to build a sidewalk. In my case, the builder chose not to. In some cases nearby, they built them, but they're wiggly, or they went around poles. Or, you know, at the end of the day, it's a city easement, and it should be the city that builds sidewalks and basically maintains them. It's a city easement.
Yeah.
Next story, also from communityimpact.com. Local organizations step up as Texas struggles to find homes for foster youth without adequate placement. The amount of time foster children in Texas are spending in hotels, offices, and other inadequate places has risen more than 1,000% since December 2019. Further, the number of children who spent at least one night without proper placement in August 2021 was more than seven times the number of children in September of 2019, says the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services. Child Protective Services is responsible for selecting an adequate placement for a child when the DFPS takes temporary or permanent custody of a child. If a placement is not found, such as with kin or foster family, the DFPS becomes the direct provider of services. These children are often placed in hotels or DFPS offices rather than foster homes or residential treatment centers. In September, a report found placing children in these settings poses substantial risks to their safety as these placements lack regulations and resources. Multiple factors have contributed to the rise in Children Without Placement, or CWOP, including hundreds of beds lost due to facility closures, the FPS's report said. Locally, Harrison Montgomery County organizations have stepped up to try to alleviate the issue. In November 2018, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals established a, quote, heightened monitoring of Texas child welfare operations. As part of that monitoring, child welfare facilities that contract with the state and have a history of policy violations are subject to increased inspections and corrective actions, according to the 2018 ruling. Those that do not comply could not receive foster youth or face fines or revoked licenses or contract terminations. As a result of the court's order, Texas has lost 2,129 general residential beds between January 2020 and September 2021, according to court monitors. Multiple pieces of state legislation passed in 2021 that sought to address these shortages. In addition, the legislature funded $83.1 million to hire 312 caseworkers, according to the DFPS September report, and allotted an additional $90 million to the DFPS, which will be used to retain providers and increase capacity to serve foster youth, according to the bills. While heightened monitoring has led to the closure of many unsafe environments for children, it has significantly stressed the system. Additional beds need to be planned to anticipate closings from heightened monitoring, a former DFPS employee said. Many child welfare organizations in Harrison Montgomery counties have tried to address the rise in children without placement, nonprofit leaders said. In July, DFPS Region 6 ended its licensing of 250 foster homes in the Houston area, which will now be operated by locally based organizations to involve the communities more. Court-appointed special advocates of Montgomery County moved into a new Conroe property in November. The new space will provide classes and connections for CWOP, Children Without Placement, something the organization could not do before, although it cannot house them in that space. So, you know, in a previous show, Andrew, remember we talked about how there probably isn't any place in the world, capitalist, socialist, or in between, that treats prisoners well?
Mm-hmm.
The Dickensian orphan story in many ways hasn't changed that much.
Yeah.
You know, a kid is taken out of what is presumed to be a dangerous or unhealthy environment where they are living with family in most cases. Mm-hmm. And then they go into a system where they might have to sleep in office spaces. Society isn't very good at taking care of its flotsam and jetsam, as it were.
Andrew? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's good that these unsafe residences have been closed, and it's great that nonprofits have stepped up to try and bolster the areas or the capacity to house these kids. But is the DFPS, like, totally turning over these foster homes to community organizations really that great of an idea? I mean, I think that DFPS should have more funding in order to open more homes where kids can help make decisions and, you know, have these homes be, you know, overseen by a state, you know, accountable, theoretically, body. And also give these kids a reliable way to alert authorities who will listen if there are problems.
You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 HD2. We air on Wednesdays, 11 a.m., more or less live. You can also hear the show on kpft.org, podcast it on your phone's app, which I think is the best idea overall. You can also go to archive.kpft.org, where this show and many others have previous airings ready for you to listen to and even download. Every story on the show, as we said earlier, is heavily excerpted, which is why you can find links to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Just click on show posts and more at the top of the page, find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can also type keywords into the search bar, which I do all the time. We're also on social media, where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. Check the show's Facebook page at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig, and look for me on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio, because I have no imagination whatsoever. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts, one of which he actually follows.
Yes, I am on Twitter, though I, as Mike mentioned, don't use it much, at DominateEYE, and spelled the same on Tumblr, which I do use, DominateEye.tumblr.com.
Our next story is from the Texas Tribune. Evictions in some Texas cities are almost back to normal levels as tenant help dries up. Since the moratorium ended in mid-August, eviction filings in three major cities tracked by Eviction Lab, Dallas, Houston, and Fort Worth, have risen to nearly pre-pandemic levels as landlords file thousands of evictions each week. It's like the silver lining is almost pre-pandemic levels, which means lower. Evictions have surged despite an abundance of job openings and financial help for struggling renters, though tenants' advocates say the billions of dollars sent to Texas to help keep people in their homes has undoubtedly prevented an even larger wave of evictions after the moratorium ended. Some of that uptick stems from landlords simply growing impatient as state and local rent relief programs take months to process applications from tenants seeking assistance, said Mark Melton, an attorney who leads the Dallas Eviction Advocacy Center and represents area tenants in eviction cases. Melton said, most of the people, quite frankly, are not a month behind. Most of them are many months behind. They've been waiting for months for Texas rent relief. On top of that, tenants in Texas's major metro areas have had to deal with dramatic rent increases sparked by a housing crunch over the past year. Amid the pandemic, state and local officials adopted measures to help keep people in their homes, such as federally funded rental assistance programs and so-called right to counsel programs that provided free legal representation for tenants facing eviction. Those benefits are now drying up. The state agency that runs Texas's $1.9 billion rent relief and eviction diversion program has shut the door to new applicants earlier this month, citing overwhelming demand for the federally funded program. However, some cities and counties could see millions of dollars sent to them to help struggling renters now seized by the U.S. Treasury Department because they haven't spent the money fast enough, according to an analysis by the nonprofit advocacy group Texas Housers. Said Julia Orduña, Southeast Texas Regional Director for Texas Housers, quote, the eviction crisis has been happening long before the pandemic and will continue to happen. We just never had a microscope up to it the way that we do right now. Many of the eviction cases now flooding Texas court dockets involve tenants directly affected by the pandemic, but many stem from, and I like the phrase, run-of-the-mill economic hardship. It's worth noting that I believe it was just last week that we discussed how apparently Montgomery County didn't have any unemployed people or sick people or, you know, people that had rent problems because they're returning $7 million to the emergency, to the U.S. Treasury. Mm-hmm. And that's from communityimpact.com, and I have that as a reference link. So as a tiny landlord, I've kind of faced both of these issues. I've had renters who fell months behind, and I did everything I could to find them rental assistance, and they did everything they could to take advantage of not only the links that I found, but also things that they found on their own. And, you know, eventually all the late fees were forgiven, and they got back on their feet, and they, with assistance, they got their rent caught up, and now we're cool. On the other hand, I had someone else who went for months without paying me rent with lame excuses, and with the threat of eviction, she found someplace else to go, making sure that after that threat, she kept living in a place rent-free for two more months, so like 7 months without rent. So I'm sympathetic to all the different sides in this problem. I think the thing that irks the most is that the money was there, and knowing Texas, there was probably a certain amount of deliberate foot-dragging in terms of dispensing it. Andrew?
I absolutely agree that the state's philosophy of using federal funding, or rather not using federal funding, definitely played a part in this. But I mean, you know, it's not just this. I mean, it as the article mentions,
run-of-the-mill economic hardship. You got to love that phrase. It's so succinct.
And you know, the article mentions and is correct in it saying, you know, this housing crisis didn't start with the pandemic. It's been coming for a long time. You know, people need somewhere to live. People don't need to profit off of others needing somewhere to live. Rent controls, real estate ownership limits, seizure and distribution of serially unoccupied property, and as a stretch goal, the abolition of landlordism would all seriously help this crisis. But at the very least, assistance programs need funding and teeth to require landlords to wait until assistance has been denied before evicting. Because otherwise, you know, we're going to have these programs here that aren't funded, aren't, you know, actually trying to do anything, or, you know, they get clogged up. And like the article mentions, The state just decides, we've got too many applicants, we're going to shut the doors. We're not going to help anybody, yep. You know?
With money going back to the Treasury.
Right.
Well, I mean, in a sort of oblique way, this references a phrase that I came up with about 25 years ago when I was getting some supervisory experience.
Mm-hmm.
You start off being the landlord. The landlord. You see, mind lock. You start off being the boss you always wanted, and you end up being the boss you always had.
Mm.
And the reason is that when you try to be thoughtful and considerate of your employees, you try to be nice, and there are always going to be a few that just take horrible advantage of you. And, you know, no one likes to be screwed over.
Mm.
So you end up hardening. You want to be nice to them. And, you know, it would be ideal to say, well, you can always be nice to the ones that deserve it and be hard to the ones that don't. But and that gets really, really hard when you also are being supervised and they can write you up for stuff.
I think that's a quite cynical way of looking at things, but I will agree with
you. I'm cynical.
I know. And I don't blame you for it. I don't blame you for it. You're set in your ways. That's fine. But I will say that there is one part of it I agree with is having people, you know, looking over you, you know, in any situation where you have power over others and you being a general, you not you specifically, you know, there are expectations put upon you by society at large or some specific person. And those expectations often make it very difficult to do something different. So if you want to, you end up
downhill.
Yeah, if you want to do something different, oftentimes you have to create the opportunity to do something different, to break free of those restrictions or expectations. And that's difficult because it's intentionally difficult. Because it's, you know, the people who set those restrictions like being able to set them. And if you could get out from under them very easily, they'd lose their power. They don't want to do that. So
I will share a piece of advice that I gave to my wife many years ago when mm-hmm. she was first starting to manage a lab. And she said it has been extremely useful that mm-hmm. if you are having a problem, a management problem, an ordering supplies problem, you know, whatever the problem is, if you're going to go to your boss mm-hmm. and complain, mm-hmm. complain with a possible solution.
Yes. Yeah.
Because if you simply go and say, I don't know what we're going to do about this, the boss's attitude more often than not is going to be, well, what do you expect me to do if you don't know what to do?
Yeah.
So if you're ever going to go into a boss, a supervisor, or manager and say, this isn't working well, we need something else, be prepared to offer one or two or three options. So at least you seem to be working on it and offering ideas. And generally, managers yeah. are more appreciative of that.
Yeah, I try to do that whenever I bring up a problem. If I can think of even a potential solution, maybe it has flaws, but, you know, it's something, I bring it to the table. Because I don't want to just put problems in people's hands and step back and say, solve this for me.
You see, even in my cynical ways, I have occasionally learned useful stuff.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it happens. Okay. From the Texas Tribune, good news, everyone. Texas grid vulnerable to blackouts during severe winter weather, even with new preparations, ERCOT estimates show. I don't think that they actually said, oh yeah, here we go. The electric, as I like to say, the Electric Unreliability Council of Texas, electrical outages in Texas could occur this winter if the state experiences a cold snap that forces many power plants offline at the same time as demand for power is high, according to an analysis by the Electric Unreliability Council of Texas. They didn't say that in the Tribune. That's me. The outages could occur despite better preparations by power plants to operate in cold weather. Heading into the winter, ERCOT considered five extreme scenarios in a risk assessment of the state's power supply. I guess what is sometimes called a stress test when they do it to financial institutions. The calculations show the power grid's vulnerability to the cumulative impact of multiple pressures could leave the system short of a significant amount of power. Power grids must keep supply and demand in balance at all times because there's really no storage at this point. We're working on it. When Texas's grid falls below its safety margin of 2,300 megawatts of extra supply, ERCOT, the grid operator, starts taking additional precautions to avoid blackouts, such as asking residents to conserve power. The calculations for severe risk this winter show that it wouldn't take a storm as bad as the one in February when hundreds of people died to take the grid offline. Hey, you know, when you have a power grid that's primed in case of secession, this is what you have to live with. The most severe scenario considered by ERCOT for this winter, very high demand for power, extensive natural gas and fossil fuel outages, and excessively low renewable power production. I don't think renewable power was ever actually the problem last February. Still does not capture the amount of power lost during February. For 2 days in February, Texas averaged 34,000 megawatts. Now, just remember, a megawatt is a million watts. So we're talking, as Doc Brown used to say, 34,000 gigawatts. No one ever corrected him. of outages, according to the recent federal report on the crisis. ERCOT's seasonal assessment for this winter estimates that the state, in a worst-case scenario, could have only about 10,000 to 19,000 megawatts of total outages at any one time, assuming better preparation by power plants for this winter as opposed to last. Makes me feel better already. Regulators in October finalized a rule that requires power plants to use, quote, best efforts, unquote, to ensure plants can operate this winter and requires them to fix, quote, unquote, acute issues from the February 2021 winter storm. According to Allison Silverstein, an expert on Texas's electricity system who formerly worked at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the Public Utility Commission of Texas, we've had years of poor planning of peak demand by ERCOT. She spoke during a public event hosted by the environmental group, the Sierra Club, on Saturday. I'm visualizing a lot of conservative listeners suddenly crossing their fingers like chase away vampires. ERCOT's a power market as a power market has historically been managed to minimize costs, not to assure excellent reliability. Four of the five extreme risk scenarios ERCOT considered would leave the grid short a significant amount of power and would trigger outages for residents. The extreme scenarios have a low chance of occurring, ERCOT emphasizes in its report. And the grid operator estimates more power generation will be available than last winter. Of course, they thought that last winter.
Mm.
Under typical winter grid conditions, the ERCOT report said, I mean, you have to parse this sentence. Under typical winter grid conditions, the ERCOT report said there will be sufficient power available to serve the state. So in other words, if all things are equal, we'll be fine. Don't worry. Now, I have to tell you, I was without power for, I don't know, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. I lost track.
Yeah.
Lost water for a couple of days. I still considered myself extremely lucky.
Yeah.
I was in a very well-insulated house. It retained heat pretty well. By the time power came on, the house had dropped to 50 degrees while the temperature outside was in the 20s and low 30s. Well, some people were burning furniture to stay warm. I was extremely fortunate, and I know it. However, I have started looking into solar power systems as sort of an energy security issue. Mm. Now, at some point when I make a final decision what I am going to do or not going to do, I'll probably talk about it on the air because I've been learning a lot. I think the main thing I have learned is that, well, solar power has gotten much less expensive. You can't call it cheap.
Mm.
And barring a substantial increase year over year in electricity rates, it will probably take 20 years to pay for the equipment. However, I will point out that I got into my current power contract. I got a 3-year contract about 2 weeks before the February freeze. Hmm. And with the price per kilowatt hour and the various other charges, you know, line maintenance and stuff like that, I'm paying about 10 cents per kilowatt hour. Before doing this show a couple of days ago, I decided to go to powertochoose.com, which is a good place to go to find your power providers in Texas. If you use it well, it's very effective.
That's powertochoose.com.
powertochoose.com.
Okay.
And it's easy to use. If there are any questions, you can always write me an email, or you can write me on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio, or you can put a message on Facebook. I'll be happy to help guys with it. You know, I'm a helpful kind of guy. But the point is that now when I go back, the best deal I could find is 15% higher than what I'm paying. And that's only 7 months on. Now, the solar provider that I've been talking to, they are guesstimating an average increase of 4.5% a year. I don't know that I entirely buy that because these things don't typically run in a straight line. But, you know, I'm already seeing a 15%, you know, from 10 cents to 11 and a half cents. That's a 15% increase.
Yeah.
So my feeling about solar power, and if you consider it, you might look at it this way as well. It's not so much that I may save money on energy. I may. But what I feel like is I'm calculating that there's a modest premium that I am paying for energy security.
Yeah.
It's like when my house burned down and I was thinking of getting an emergency generator, one of these things that you put in the backyard, it automatically turns on, it runs on natural gas, it's automatic. At the time, that was running like $10,000 plus install. And my wife and I felt that that was worth the security. Except that we couldn't pass code. Our yard was too small. Right. I see this the same way. So I kind of pick a number, $10,000 over X number of years, say 10 years. And if that's as much as I pay over and above what electric would have cost, I feel like that's an insurance premium for energy security. So that's kind of where I am on that, because whatever it is, I think we can all agree we don't have a lot of faith in the Texas power grid. Andrew?
Yeah. I mean, you know, ERCOT is what you get when you run a government entity for efficiency or profit over service. And also, as you said earlier, with a, shall we say, unrealistic secessionist mindset, you know?
Yep.
Fiscal responsibility kills. Let's hope it doesn't kill again this winter.
Well, I realize I'm using Texas as this example. It does, I think, offer some example that it's all well and good to talk about a socialized economy where you are trusting the government to use its assets to take care of the people so no one is excessively poor and no one is excessively rich, and yet there are incentives built into the system and people, you know, can earn and create and do other things. Unless you kind of have a government like Texas, and then you're up a creek.
Well, that's true, but that's true for any system where there's a government that has a significant amount of power. You know, you need to make sure that the people in government aren't, like, idiots. And unfortunately, Texas hasn't quite managed that.
Well, so. I mean, that's where the balance of power comes in. You know, it's a topic we haven't talked about much. We haven't talked about it much. I think that public media don't talk about it much. But, you know, when Obama, I remember very clearly, there was a young kid. He was in the debating society. He was over at the house for a while. We were watching TV. We got to talking. And at the time, Obama was president, and all these governors from red states and attorneys general from red states, they're all suing for this reason or that reason. And the reasons were obviously, I'm going to use the term advisedly, evil. And he asked me, why do the states have that right? Why can't the federal government just do what it wants and, you know, the states can't sue them for it? And I said something at the time that I never dreamed would be as accurate as it was. But I said to him, well, because sometimes it turns out that you have a federal government that's doing things you don't like, and then you're grateful for the fact that the states can sue the feds.
Yeah.
It's a balance of power thing, and it does shift depending on who's in power and what laws are currently applicable. And, you know, unless one party starts to try to engineer the system to keep itself in power. Now, in Texas, that was the PRI. And in the United States, it appears to be the Republicans.
Yeah. You know, the sort of analogy that you can make for the balance of power and states and the federal government having the power to sue each other is kind of like, you know, in a zombie apocalypse, everybody's got a gun and they can all shoot each other if they start to turn, you know? And they do. Because,
and
you
sometimes
know,
they don't
know.
Shoot them if they start to turn. They start to turn after they've been shot.
That's true.
Yeah.
But
okay, I have to digress. I swore that I was past discussing The Walking Dead. Okay.
Okay.
I did. I several years ago, I felt that The Walking Dead had sort of jumped the shark conversation wise for this show.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that Morgan on Fear the Walking Dead is a serious loose cannon who's constantly ignoring consensus and going off on his own way and often causes additional problems and injuries. Mm. I've noticed that while they've in Walking Dead World Beyond, yeah, I follow all these things. God help me. In Walking Dead World Beyond, they've been talking about explaining something that has been an obvious problem, which is that the Walking Dead are decomposing.
Mm.
And if you've been watching some of the Walking Dead, they are partially skeletal.
Yeah.
Now, I don't care what kind of MacGuffin, as Hitchcock used to say, I don't care what kind of MacGuffin you're using to just make the dead walk. But even Walking Dead requires something akin to muscles to make them walk.
Mm.
If the muscles have decomposed, they cannot walk, unless now we're talking magic, which the show has never gotten involved in.
Right.
So, you know, it's like, I, as a personality, I'm a completist, right? I have a coin collection, and when I was an active coin collector, I was a completist. Like, I wanted every Mercury dime from, like, 1917 to 1944, whenever the last one was. Mm. I'm a complete. So I'm watching shows. It gets to a point sometimes where I want them to put me out of my misery. Just cancel it. You know, don't make me do the hard work. Just don't air it anymore, and then I'm free.
Mm.
Kind of like that opening to Robot Chicken where the mad scientist props the chicken's eyes open so he has to watch TV. Yeah, it's a little bit of a metaphor, but... Okay, well, we should probably stop having fun and actually talk about news and get depressed. Yeah.
This has been Mike's media moment.
I can't help myself. It's part of the joy of having radio, and all sure. I can hope is that you find these digressions mildly amusing.
Yes.
I truly do hope so. I think we might as well do our second break now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays more or less live at 11 a.m., and you can listen to the show at kpft.org, podcast it on your phone's podcast app, my recommendation. You can also go and listen to this and other previously broadcast shows at archive.kpft.org. Now, KPFT is Houston's community station. That means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied programming. You can go to the new kpft.org. I swear, it really is a new page that's been kind of kept up to date. And hit the donate button, pick your favorite show, which may be ours, subtle hint, and the amount of your donation, be it large, small, or in between, and you might even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Or you can waive the thank you gift, and then a little bit more of your donation goes to the station, although some of the gifts are pretty cool.
Yeah.
You can also donate by texting the word GIVE, G-I-V-E, to 713-526-5738. That's GIVE at 713-526-5738. Or you know what? If you're like one of these chatter people that strikes up conversations while you're waiting in line at supermarkets or movie theaters or sitting on benches, I'm like that. I'm incorrigible. just spread the word. Bring the conversation around to KPFT. It can be subtle. It doesn't have to be subtle. Maybe you'll find a kindred spirit that goes, wow, really? I didn't realize there was a station like that here. Tell me about some of the shows. And there you go. You've now found a compadre for KPFT. It's just that simple, folks. It's not hard.
Yeah.
Okay. Next story from the Texas Tribune. And I know that you'll be happy to hear this. U.S. Rep. Louie Gohmert joins Texas Republicans running against Attorney General Ken Paxton.
Hooray.
At least three Democrats. Hmm? Yeah. Oh, was that a hooray?
Hooray. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to understand what it was you were saying before I continued. At least, and this is something that's interesting. They mentioned this in like the secondary headline. At least three Democrats are also running for the job. Interestingly, nowhere in the article do they name them. But be that as it may, I will name them because I looked it up. U.S. Representative Louie Gohmert, representative of Tyler, Texas, announced Monday he is running for attorney general. So he got his $1 million within more or less 10 days, kind of, sort of, he didn't say. Gohmert is one of the most far-right members of Congress and an ardent supporter of former President Donald Trump, who has endorsed Paxton for another term. According to the Minnesota Star Tribune, the candidates seeking the Democratic nomination for attorney general include Dallas area civil rights attorney Lee Merritt, former Galveston mayor Joe Jaworski, maybe distantly related to Leo Jaworski, the famous lawyer. I don't know if he is, and I don't know if he'll try to capitalize on that. And also Rochelle Garza, a former lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union from the Rio Grande Valley. And there is a link to the Star Tribune story if you want to go there and get a little bit more information. Now we get to some of the – I'm sorry. Did you want to say something, Andrew?
Yeah. Well, I just find it interesting that we're going to have two Trumpists fighting each other, you know, battling it out for the nomination, and theoretically Trump's love. But you know what? As for Gohmert, I hope he loses for all our sakes.
Well, there was another possible contender, Kraus. Forget his first name. He was trying to outright Abbott, and apparently he's dropped out. So I guess when Gohmert got in, it's like, hey, there's only so crazy I can go. You know, everybody has their limit.
Yeah.
Okay. The next story is from Gizmodo.com. And this is worth paying attention to. The plague is more likely now thanks to climate change. A new study examines how rising temperatures in the western U.S. have influenced plague outbreaks. Yes, that plague. The risk of plague spilling over from animals to humans in the western U.S. has increased since 1950 thanks to climate change, a new study has found. Importantly, the research gives valuable insights into how this deadly disease has historically moved and developed in the U.S., which can help us understand more about its future. We want to understand where the plague, yes, the plague, which is still a common wildlife disease, can exist in the United States, how where it can exist has changed over the last century, and why plague can exist in those places that it does, and not, say, 20 miles further up or down the road, study co-author Boris Schmidt said in an email. Yersinia pestis is the bacteria that causes plague, including that plague, the medieval Black Death. Funny, we talked about March last year, that. Which killed around 25 million people over the course of 4 years in the 1300s. That amounted to about a third to a half of the European population at the time. The bacteria spread to humans from animals, most infamously rats, which carry plague-infested fleas on them. Scientists have theorized that the plague, like many other infectious diseases, will probably increase its spread to humans as the planet warms and people come increasingly closer into contact with wild animals. But there's not a lot of research out there on what historically are the best conditions for the plague to develop and get out of control. As a result, there are still a lot of big questions about the plague that remain unanswered. The study authors set about to get a better handle on these details. They found, for example, that rodent communities in certain areas at higher elevations were up to 40% more likely to harbor the disease, while the researchers say, which the researchers say is attributable to warming since 1950. Just because there's a growing probability that plague can develop thanks to climate change doesn't mean you need to start worrying about the second coming of the Black Death. Nowadays, it's pretty treatable with modern antibiotics, but still not exactly something you want to risk lots of people catching. According to study author Boris Schmidt in an email, plague is probably pretty low on the things to worry about compared to, say, risks of forest fire, etc., when the U.S. is heating up. But the research does have important ramifications for other types of diseases and an ominous look into our future. One crucial point, the study illustrates just how just counting human cases of plague underestimates the amount of the disease incubating in wild areas in the western U.S. According to study co-author Colin Carlson over Twitter, he says, I think we've probably underestimated just how much climate change could affect human and animal health. there's this conventional wisdom that the biggest impacts are going to be from heat and disasters and weather. I just don't think that's a sure thing. I think it's just harder to reconstruct the climate signal for infectious diseases because they're a bit more complicated biologically. But the pandemic is telling us just how much those diseases matter for the world. Even rare spillover events can have big consequences. I think the lesson here is as more of the Earth warms and presents attractive habitat to animals that have typically been confined to tropical areas, they will bring new diseases with them, whether it's new viruses, new bacteria, new parasites, for example, malaria. I believe the area that is affected by malaria now has been spreading. There's concern that the area affected by Ebola can spread. There's concern that as animals lose habitat in rainforests, they're going to bring new viruses with them, some of which may be able to make the jump to humans. Basically, it's kind of like the old Hershey's chocolate commercial that they once had, where you have a bunch of little kids, last day of school, the teacher is happy and just kind of chirpy, and the kids are all chirpy, and the light is nice, and the teacher says, I'll be seeing you all next year, and we can look forward to seeing each other again. The kids are going, yay! And then comes next fall, and it's not the same teacher, and she's like got the yardstick in her hand ready for corporal punishment. And the punchline of the commercial is, change is bad. And I have never thought of a commercial that sums up climate change quite like that. Andrew, well, I guess I've had enough.
Well, reading this article, the only thing I could really think about was kind of tangential, because I feel like this is all sort of well laid out here. You know, the stakes are appropriately laid out. You know, this isn't the worst thing in the world that could come from climate change, but it's something to keep an eye on. But, you know, whenever I talk about climate change with my mom, she routinely brings out the same argument that Earth has natural warming and cooling cycles, and that we are just going through another one of those. And that's her sort of climate denial argument of choice, essentially. And, you know, for the longest time, I just really hadn't seen anything talking about that at all, in support of it, against it, whatever. It just seemed like it wasn't an argument that anybody had addressed. And so I really had no way of responding to it, despite the fact that I kind of intuitively felt like it wouldn't stand up to scrutiny. But that changed a couple of days ago when my union was discussing in our chat room Naomi Klein's book, How to Change Everything, which does actually address this and refutes this claim. So basically, those warming and cooling cycles did happen, but they happened over thousands of years for each cycle, whereas recent global warming is happening over about 100 or so years so far, which is exactly the problem. You know, long cycles allow for animals and plants. Yeah, yeah. Oh, they allow the species living on the Earth to adapt to the new conditions. And so even though the climate may be radically different in the middle of the cycle, you know, the species on Earth are still existing. But, you know, a cycle that happens over only 100 or so years is happening too fast to really allow evolution to adapt, to allow organisms on the planet to adapt. It's kind of like if when you're driving, you come to a controlled stop versus slamming on the brakes. You know, the former you'll probably be okay, but the latter you might injure some people. So, you know, that's the sort of basic idea behind it. But as for evidence of human activity, in past warming cycles, carbon dioxide levels went up after the warming started. It was, you know, a cause and effect sort of thing. Whereas this time, we've had more CO2, more carbon dioxide in the air first, and then the warming started. So the carbon dioxide levels elevating corresponds with the sort of development of human industry. So, you know, it's that sort of, you know, that's what people are sort of relying on as, you know, this is us. We're doing this because it lines up with our activities, and warming happened afterward as opposed to before. You know, this explanation isn't going to magically, you know, convince anybody who's denying climate change that it's a real thing, of course. But I figured because I was having so much trouble finding any information on it at all, I figured, you know, you would probably appreciate it. And I hope you do.
I do. And I will add a couple of things.
Mm.
Next time your mother brings up the natural climate cycles of the Earth, of which there are some, there is a polar nutation where it's not always at 23 degrees. Sometimes it's at 21 and a half. Sometimes it's at 24. The Earth's orbit around the sun is not circular. It's elliptical. Sometimes summer happens when it's closer to the sun. Sometimes summer happens when it's further from the sun. And all of these things affect climate, which, by the way, most people don't understand is distinct from weather. Weather is like what you're going to encounter outside. Climate is like what your state or part of the country is starting to experience, or continent. So even with these normal orbital variations, magnetic field variations, axial Earth axis variations, here's the one point to remember. Species went extinct.
Yeah.
Even with the long cycles, species went extinct. And we are not immune. As for the carbon dioxide, as you pointed out, I believe that at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and they know this because they have like ice samples with air trapped inside that they can date, they can actually measure the changes in gas mix. And I think that like, 200 or 300 years ago, the atmosphere was 250 parts per million carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's something like 420 parts per million carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
And on top of that is the methane.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to get into cow butt methane, but, you know, there's a lot of methane from like decomposing matter.
And there's radiation as well. There's several, like for Geiger counters, they actually have to go to scrappers and get metal specifically from, I forget when, but like, you know, before the 1940s and all this sort of time period, because after, you know, the discovery of the nuclear bomb and all this sort of thing and the proliferation of nuclear energy, a lot more radiation entered the atmosphere. And so if you use that kind of metal for Geiger counters, well, you're not going to get as accurate of a read.
There are a lot of implications, but the bottom line is that, yes, the Earth has its normal climatic variations due to various aspects of its orbit and its orientation and its magnetic field. All humans are doing is making it worse.
Mm.
So far. Yeah, they're right. It's natural, except we're making it worse very fast.
Yeah.
So to me, it makes perfect sense to allow, yes, there's natural variation in climate. We just have to try to keep to the natural variation and not make it worse.
Exactly.
It seems a modest goal in principle. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2. We air on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can hear the show on kpft.org when it's online. You can podcast it, my preferred suggestion. Or you can go to archive.kpft.org, where you can listen to prior airings of this show, as well as almost 100 other shows from KPFT. Okay, our next show, or rather our next story, this is from The Guardian. The U.S. was added to a list of backsliding democracies for the first time. This is from AFP, Agence France-Presse. Horrible pronunciation in Stockholm, via The Guardian. The U.S. has been added to an annual list of backsliding democracies for the first time, the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance think tank has said, pointing to a visible deterioration it said began in 2019. Globally, more than 1 in 4 people live in a backsliding democracy, a proportion that rises to more than 2 in 3. 2 in 3 with the addition of authoritarian or hybrid regimes, according to the think tank. The report says, quote, a historic turning point came in 2020 to 2021 when former President Donald Trump, at least they didn't have to say President and Trump consecutively, questioned the legitimacy of the 2020 election results in the United States. In addition, Hudson pointed to a decline in the quality of freedom and association and assembly during the summer of protests in 2020 after the police killing of George Floyd. The organization's Secretary General, Kevin Casas Zamora, said, "The visible deterioration of democracy in the U.S. as seen in the increasing tendency to contest credible election results, the efforts to suppress participation in election, and the runaway polarization is one of the most concerning developments. The number of backsliding democracies has doubled in the past decade, adding for a quarter of the world's population. In addition to established democracies such as the U.S., the list also includes EU member states Hungary, Poland, and Slovenia. We're in good company." Two countries, that were on the list last year, Ukraine and North Macedonia, were removed this year after their situations improved. Two others, Mali and Serbia, left the list because they were no longer considered democracies. So, thank the Republican Party. Their plan is working.
Mm. Well, you know, the U.S. going onto this list is long overdue, in my opinion. I mean, protest freedom, especially around racial issues, has never been good here. I mean, anybody familiar with the history of the United States and race relations in this country knows that. It's been better than many other places, but it's not been good enough. Electoral suppression is similar, both for voters along racial lines, but also in competitiveness of elections, with suppression of alternate parties outside of the two-party duopoly. I think if we want to keep representative democracy in place but improve our situation, reforms like the Fair Representation Act and most of the Freedom to Vote Act, minus the campaign finance provisions, links to both of those with information on both those legislations are on the blog post at thinkwingradio.com, are necessary. Otherwise, we could always experiment with direct democracy. See if that improves things.
if it ain't working, if it hasn't worked in the past, just keep trying it. That's all we have time for today. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on 90.1 KPFT HD2, Houston's community station. My co-host, indispensable editor, and animal carer for is Andrew Ferguson.
they don't understand that. They haven't listened to our preparations, so they never understand what that means.
Well, they should inquire. We have ways of being contacted.
True. Yes.
And then I can post pictures of my cat, you can post pictures of your dogs, and we can say this is the reason we always record the show 1 or 2 hours later than we had hoped. but hope springs eternal, but the care and well-being of animals comes first.
True.
Just the way it is. Okay, we hope you've enjoyed the show, and we'll look forward to speaking to you again next week. Hope we'll find something interesting, challenging, thought-provoking for you to hear. Everyone take care.
See you later.
It's not too late.
Greetings, KPFT listeners. This is DJ Metalord, host of Sweet Nightmares Radio Show. Sweet Nightmares Radio Show has been supporting the metal underground and everything in between, from the classics to the newest releases, since 1987. You can catch the show every Thursday, 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. on the FM band. Also, listen to an encore presentation every Saturday. Yes, every Saturday, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. on the HD2 channel. Sweet Nightmares, only on 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Hi, I'm Charles Hightower, host of the R&B Gold Show, 6 p.m. till 8, right here on KPFT, Houston's Community Station. I'll be moving and grooving with all the good classic soul just for you on KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston.
Hello, Houston. This is your forecast for KPFT as followed. For today, expected to be partly sunny with a high near 75. For tonight, a slight chance of showers between 10 p.m. and midnight. However, mostly cloudy with a low around 66. And for your Thanksgiving, possible showers and thunderstorms. We'll keep you updated on that as we get closer to the day. This is your forecast for KPFT.